This is Set Aside Some Time, an MSPN podcast, and it's brought to you by the National MSP Network, or MSPN for short. And now, on to the episode.
Thank you for setting aside some time for us today. My name is Rasa Fumagalli. I'm the Director of Medicare Compliance at Synergy and your host for today's podcast. Also joining us today are Annie Davidson and Bridget Smith. Annie Davidson is the Vice President of Client Success at ExamWorks Compliance Solutions. Bridget Smith is a Senior Vice President of National Accounts and Settlement Consulting at Impax. Thank you for joining us, ladies.
Thank you.
So yes. Today's podcast is going to focus on Medicare secondary payer compliance considerations when it comes to settlements with causation and pre-existing condition disputes. We're also going to apply those considerations to the specific case study facts that were introduced in our first podcast for the year. We're doing something a little different this year. If you missed that podcast or you simply want a refresher, our case study involves Joe, who works for a flooring company installing carpeting. On November 5th of 2020, he's involved in a car accident while driving to a job site and he hurts his right knee. He reports the accident to his employer, goes to the occupational health clinic for care. His diagnosis is right wrist contusion, right knee sprain. He continues to have issues, so a subsequent MRI of the right knee shows a torn meniscus as well as osteoarthritis. Joe has a surgical repair of the torn meniscus on February 5th, 2021. He undergoes a course of physical therapy and returns to his regular employment as a flooring installer. His employer's workers' compensation carrier pays for medical and indemnity benefits for this claim. After Joe's back at work for about 3 months, he starts to experience more swelling in his right knee, and he feels that he's unable to perform his regular employment duties. His treating physician takes him off from work and recommends a total right knee replacement. Joe then begins to complain of left knee pain, and he starts to complain of pain in his right wrist. When Joe presents the total knee replacement authorization request to the workers' comp carrier denies the request. Joe applies for and is awarded Social Security disability benefits. The workers' comp carrier and Joe are currently discussing settlement of his claim. He will become Medicare eligible in June of 2024. So the causation pre-existing condition issues here, of course, involve the right knee torn meniscus and the subsequent recommendation for total knee replacement. We also have his complaints of problems in the other knee, which develop a few months later, as well as this new pain in the right wrist. So since Medicare's interest in a workers' compensation settlement really should be driven by the workers' comp state laws, let's talk about them a little bit. Both Annie and Bridget have backgrounds in workers' compensation insurance defense. So I thought we would start out with just a general discussion of, you know, how do most workers' comp laws deal with work injury aggravations? Bridget, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So with aggravations, they're always looking at the extent of the aggravation. And in this scenario, we could assume that it's all the same carrier, right? Or different carriers, depending on the time, and which adds some more complexity to it.
For sure. Right? Let's keep it as the same carrier. Same employer, same carrier.
So really looking at what's the extent of that aggravation, right? What was the claimant doing, taking as far as medication before? What did the x-rays or in this case, the MRIs actually show? Was there some degeneration before? Were there some issues before? Had he been seen before for these types of issues? With respect to the left knee, the left knee, I always look to what's plausible to a judge, right? And it is plausible that if you're, you know, treating your right knee very tenderly, that you could have some left knee issues. But, you know, how old is he? He's applied, you know, that's a part of life, some of those left knee issues. So you really want to dig deep in those cases and look at the totality of the medical, and then parcel it apart to see exactly what defenses you have to that claim.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're trying to, you know, just clarify what the pre-existing condition was, you know, yes, to see exactly what it was. And I know in Illinois, for example, aggravations of pre-existing conditions are considered compensable.
Oh, you know, in Pennsylvania too.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Annie, how about, I think Minnesota is your state? Is that, though you, of course, are national in MSP?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I would be thinking about it exactly the same way. If I put back on my insurance defense hat, I want to think about exactly what's the nature and extent here. I'm curious to know how long he was a flooring installer, because in our fact pattern, you know, you have a specific motor vehicle accident occurring on November 5th, 2020, with a right knee sprain strain sort of coming out of that, and a right wrist contusion. But then, right, we get to imaging. Now we're seeing osteoarthritis, meniscus tear. Now, if he's been flooring installer for this employer for 20 years, I'm also starting to think, if this guy lawyers up, if he's not already lawyered up, you know, I can foresee, in Minnesota, we would call it a Gillette injury. California, you hear cumulative trauma. Other places, you hear repetitive trauma, repetitive stress. I'm going to tuck that in the back of my head. Am I going to see that piece? Because exactly, in Minnesota, yes, there are instances where if you aggravate an underlying condition, whether it's work related or not, you've bought it to some extent. So Minnesota is on par with both of your states as well. And that's exactly where my mind was going with this, is what more could come from this. But now maybe he, you know, worked, you know, for years and years at a sedentary office job and just started flooring installing, you know, last week. I don't know. So, yeah.
For sure. Or you perhaps might have an investigator who sees that this guy has his own side business of installing flooring, where he's only working for your company maybe 2 days a week or something of that nature. So, you know, in most workers' comp jurisdictions, you know, it does seem that aggravations of work, you know, pre-existing conditions, work aggravations of pre-existing conditions would be considered to be compensable. The question is, at what point do you come back to baseline? So these are all determinations that an arbitrator or a mediator, depending in your jurisdiction, you know, what they might be doing or thinking about. So now, when we have situations where we are asked to project whether we are preparing the Medicare set-aside recommendations, or our team of allocators, nurses, doctors, or whoever the case may be, you know, what should they be thinking about when they're projecting future treatment for an aggravation of a pre-existing condition? I don't know, Annie, if you want to sort of give it a stab in terms of, you know, what you think allocators, how they should be addressing these aggravations, whether they're temporary or permanent.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as any person who's handling cases like this, if you're a claims person or an attorney, either, you know, defending this case or bringing a case like this, you're always hyper fixated on arising out of, and the course and scope of that kind of stuff, and the nature and extent of the injury. So this is getting back to this aggravation. You're looking at that nature and extent. I want to know if it's a temporary aggravation that comes back to baseline pretty quickly. Or is it, in Minnesota, we get into a difference between an aggravation versus an exacerbation. Mm-hmm. Exacerbation is really what you're looking at there. Where you're going to kind of be on the hook, where you bought the whole thing. And so that piece is going to play into the analysis for me. And I think for any type of payer, it also, and the person writing the MSA. And so the other thing that comes up in the back of my mind too, just looking at this fact pattern, and as this case walks in the door, I'm talking in the back of my head, we know he's not on Medicare yet, but I know he's going to get on Medicare June 1st, basically. So we got a couple of months here. Am I in a place where I'm going to be able to go ahead and you know, get this settled and wrapped up and have a court sign off on this, you know, before June 1st hits. And then I also want to know what the total settlement amount is. Like, if the parties are looking at settlement here, those are things that are always helpful for your allocator to know, because it's going to give me some guideposts on what's going on here and whether we're looking at, you know, something that you could potentially submit to CMS or something that could never be submitted to CMS because it doesn't meet their workload review thresholds. And then from there, I'm looking at what do those prior records. This is a situation where you'd want to give your allocator some records that predate the injury. Is there imaging? Right. Did he know he had osteoarthritis of the knee and he's been treating for knee pain on his own for years? That's super helpful to know. And then maybe we can spot where he hits baseline. Because in this fact pattern, he got, you know, there was a meniscal repair. He had torn his meniscus. There's a repair that took place that the carrier paid for. So in a lot of instances, you might argue he was back to baseline. You know, he had a successful repair and he was back to baseline for some period of time before now he starts coming in with these complaints again. So from an allocator standpoint, it's going to be helpful to have records that predate if you have them. It's going to be helpful to see what happened after the meniscal repair and where he ended up, and then projecting care out from there. Maybe you have a treater who released him and said no future care, rarely ever happens in comp, but then you have a basis for potentially a medical zero on that condition versus he does need some amount of conservative care, or we now know, right? He's staring down a total knee replacement. And that's where you're going to be looking at that defense. One other thing I would note too is, and Bridget, you mentioned this in episode 40, when we sort of introduced this fact pattern, if you're submitting, so in this case, if the parties are settling for more than $250,000, Medicare struggles. If you don't have a very black and white case, and they take this position of you paid for it, you bought it. So the fact mm-hmm. that you paid for that meniscal tear repair likely means if you're going to be submitting to Medicare, you have a huge uphill battle to try to prove that the total knee should not come in. So I'm saying, you know, and Bridget, you can chime in after me, but like if you're going to be submitting to Medicare on this, I think you're going to have a heck of a time keeping out the total knee. Based on these facts. But Bridget, please chime in and share your perspective too.
Yeah, Annie, everything you said, I completely agree with. And, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about getting as many records as you can for that allocator that predate the injury. I also think that you're really looking at what was the treatment, right? Because if it's the same medication the claimant was on, you know, at the time of the original injury, then there's an argument there that says nothing's changed. That's something that is part and parcel of something else, right? So looking for that, and this is a really ripe case for some mitigation, right? If there's an opportunity from the treating provider to, and you know, it might not happen like you said, but if the treating provider is comfortable with saying, you know, it's a temporary aggravation, this is related to pre-existing issues with arthritis, then it doesn't go in the MSA at all. And I think then that battle with CMS is really, you've got your shield and your armor for that battle with CMS. So, but you're right. If you paid for it, you know, CMS will most likely say you bought it. You just have to have some compelling evidence, like a doctor's note, maybe a prior recommendation of surgery, even before this all happened. But you need some substance on it. You might even want to consider, you know, breaking up some of the litigation to deal with some of these issues to provide a court order hearing on the merits to CMS.
Absolutely. If you have a court order after hearing on the merits that finds that the knee replacement is due to a completely unrelated condition, you are going to have much greater success when you are submitting this to CMS. I do think a question is, would you actually feel compelled to submit this type of case to CMS since CMS review is purely voluntary? And so assuming that you know, the knee replacement really is tied to the osteoarthritis, there's a history of knee complaints, you know, over the past 10 years or so, Medicare in my experience, they might look at the fact that he's a flooring installer, and whether or not there actually is a claim for repetitive trauma, they on their own might decide or point to, well, he installed floors. Surely this is because of that, which is, you know, technically improper. If there isn't a claim being made for repetitive trauma, Medicare should not be substituting their own opinion on what the case is about. So, all right. So when we're talking though about future treatment allocations, I mean, it sounded like, you know, both of you are going to strongly urge your allocators, whoever is doing it, to look at the medical records that predate the date of the accident. What I have seen some allocators do, and I would like to get your thoughts on it, is they sometimes will actually price out, or not price out, just project out, given this diagnosis, what is the future care going to look like? And then once you have that sort of framework, you then factor in the aggravation. And then you might see, well, rather than one visit to the doctor, which he would have because of this osteoarthritis, now he's likely to have two. So then their projection for an aggravation would be one visit per year. So they're kind of like taking the baseline treatment projections. If there's any change, they're only going to be projecting for the change. Is this what you have seen your allocators do as well, or?
So I think it just depends on the case, right? But I do think you really do need to parcel out past from present, right? You know, then from now. And if there is, I mean, like Rossi, you said, if the claimant's doctor's visits have increased, then what were they before? And so what are they now? So they may increase one. Well, that would make sense. You know, it's that evidence-based mentality, and just realistic mentality. And also, you know, it's right in the medical records. There's support for that, right?
Right.
If medications change or dosages amounts change, that's something you're looking at too. Because often if there is an aggravation, there can be a change in treatment. So those are the types of things I would be looking at.
For sure. So now, Annie, I'm curious, have you seen Medicare actually analyze these aggravations, MSAs with aggravations, where they are sort of taking into account the fact that this person was treating beforehand?
Yes, I have. I've worked on very specific cases in the past, and I think of things like a good one to think about is, you know, somebody has an injury and hasn't come up in this fact pattern, but there's no reason that it wouldn't be layered in here for him. He has, you know, this knee condition going on, and maybe, you know, he's taking some medication for pain. Maybe he was doing that before the injury, but you definitely see it with psychological injuries. So if somebody has an underlying depression injury and then this ends up exacerbating his depression, one thing we've done in the past is you'll take, you know, the dosage he was taking before the injury, and now maybe he has to increase that for some amount of time or forever. And then, right, you just price in the 5 milligram difference or the 10 milligram difference. So CMS is able to do that if you're submitting to CMS. I've seen them do it. They'll approve it. And kind of like what Bridget was talking about, where, you know, and even you, Rasa, you said he would always need that one visit. Now he needs two. So you're allocating one. That kind of apportionment CMS can deal with. What CMS can't deal with and is certainly available to us in our jurisdictions, and Rasa, you hit on this, you hit the nail on the head perfectly. Everything that we do in terms of complying with the Medicare secondary payer statute is still born out of state workers' compensation injuries and the law that surrounds them. And what CMS cannot deal with, and I just had a conversation with them recently, as part of the MSPM board about, and I know we'll talk about this in a minute, they want to require reporting of the total settlement amount that's allocated for future care starting in April of 2025. When a case settles, they want to know that amount. And one of the questions I pose to them is, what do I do when I work with 19 different defendants in Minnesota who are settling out a comp claim with one MSA, and it's all the same date of injury, whether they submit it or not? Submitting it is a huge issue. And some of them may be paying a half share. Some of them may be paying a full share. Some of them may have three shares. CMS doesn't have the ability to allow apportionment amongst the defendants. That's not in play here. With this fact pattern, we're saying is one defendant. But CMS also historically does not let you say, okay, this injury is 20%, you know, your injury. And 80% of it was his underlying osteoarthritis. We know jurisdictions let you do that. Minnesota doesn't really happen to be one of them, but there are other jurisdictions out there that let you do that, where you can apportion amongst the pre-existing injury and the new aggravation or exacerbation. CMS historically hasn't let you do that. So in this fact pattern, if you're in a jurisdiction where you want to take advantage of that apportionment, I'm going to push you not to submit. And then I'm going to tell you probably consider an evidence-based MSA or something like that. The other way you can't apportion too is, you know, two carriers. So this was a motor vehicle accident. Let's say they want to subrogate, right? And they want to go after that. You know, you can have an agreement, and this is what we do in Minnesota. The party, you can get a ruling on this in Minnesota too, and a lot of other jurisdictions, saying you're 60%, you're 40%. Mm-hmm. You go in together, you get an MSA, you get it approved by CMS, and it's $100,000. One of you pays 60 and one of you pays 40 at the end. You apportion in the background because CMS won't do it through their submission process. So these pieces come into play with him, with our fact pattern, getting back to this fact pattern here. Yes, you can, if you're submitting to CMS, get the dosages and the care apportioned, but you can't have CMS approving your MSA and necessarily honoring what the apportionment looks like in that jurisdiction, right? Unfortunately. You can still do it behind the scenes, but CMS isn't going to help you do it.
Absolutely. And so this particular fact pattern, as we put it together, we wanted to throw in a liability component there. We've got that motor vehicle accident. We've got the suggestion of repetitive trauma, all of these sort of things that really we often face in the real world. So kind of picking up on, you know, the point that you made, Annie, about reporting the MSA amount that is going to have to be part of the TPOC reporting in April of next year. So that reporting is going to be done whether it's submitted to CMS for review or not submitted to CMS for review. Given the workers' comp reference guide, I think it was section 4.3 or something, where, you know, Medicare said that it was all about promoting their request and desire that people submit to CMS for review, and their statement that when you have a non-submit, you know, at first, they seemed to think that that was going to be a presumption of you're trying to cost shift, which is so wrong. And then they sort of walked it back. So the question is, when you're going to have that reporting of the MSA in the workers' comp TPOC situation, if you have a non-submit, do you anticipate that Medicare set-asides might contain additional information, or you might have a more detailed record keeping if you were ever called upon the need to support how this was a reasonable figure that you came up with?
So
either of you?
Yeah, sure. I would say that in general, you should always have that, right? Because when you're doing an evidence-based non-submit, you know, you're looking in at all of that, and you're layering all of that within your MSA. Why this is the case, why this allocation makes sense. And you're using all, like, if there's a court order, if there's a statute, if you know, if there's something from the doctor, that all should be within the MSA itself to memorialize all of that. So I think that's very, very, very important. And CMS, on the first call that we had about their wish to do this, you know, one of the things that was discussed over and over again, and I had asked a question about it because I wanted to make clear that this is still a voluntary process, right? It is still a voluntary process. This does not require putting a number in the TPOC for the MSA amount. Does not mean that somehow we all have to submit to CMS, right? It is showing that you have a consideration of Medicare's interest. And the vehicle you use to do that should support that, regardless of whether it's submitted or it's not submitted to CMS. The vehicle should stand on its own. And so I think that's really important. Sometimes it gets lost in a lot of the rhetoric that goes out there.
Yeah,
I
and if I
mean,
can just add to that too. Oh, sorry, Rosa. I'll just add to that quickly. One of the things I clarified with them last week, and we'll be sharing this more broadly with our membership, is it truly they want to report. We've had this voluntary process, and people have gotten used to these voluntary workload review thresholds. But reporting to Medicare, reporting a settlement to Medicare occurs when you settle and you pay more than $750 right now. And Medicare has said that they want the amount that you are putting towards future care to be populated in those Section 111 reports when you're at $750 and one penny and above. So now you have folks who've kind of been getting away with treating the $25,000 threshold for beneficiaries or the $250,000 threshold for folks like our guy here, our flooring guy. They've been treating those as safe harbors and not doing anything. So things are going to come home to roost. But when reporting these, Rasa, I agree. You're going to be putting in the amount that you're allocating, whether it's an evidence-based or a traditional Medicare set aside. And I agree with what Bridget said. There's always a clinical foundation for what you're allocating in these. There's always a pharmaceutical foundation. There is a legal foundation if you have it. So at least you should be. You should be working with a vendor who's going to make sure that you're not doing a race to the bottom, that you have the support for why you're allocating the way you are. And non-submit, and this gets at the challenge you talked about, Rasa, why CMS had to walk back their statement is because non-submits are not on their face cost shifting. I would argue, and many of us do argue this to CMS, the fight that we have and why people choose not to participate in their voluntary processes much anymore is because there's a fight over probable care versus possible care. And if you tell me that this fact pattern with this floor installer is going to settle for more than $250,000, that total knee is coming in. And if they've altered their gait, to Bridget's point earlier, they've altered their gait, they're treating it much more tenderly, that left knee, that might be coming in as consequential. Hopefully you've denied it and you didn't pay anything on it, and maybe we can treat it like a mini legal zero. But it starts to get very bonkers very quickly when you're submitting to CMS by no reason other than they grab possible care. And evidence-based MSAs are saying, whoa, 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 what's happening in the real world? Let's look at the probable care. So I'm comfortable with reporting that amount with the TPOC. I think it is not an RRE's responsibility. It is not a carrier's responsibility. Post-settlement, that coordination of benefits is 100% on the beneficiary. So I do question the premise. Of course, CMS can require what they want in Section 111 reporting. Fine, I'll concede that. But coordination of benefits after primary payment has occurred, that's on the beneficiary. So I think there are a lot of unintended consequences. We don't have to get into it here, but there are unintended consequences that CMS has not thought about or thought through with making the reporting of an MSA amount mandatory.
So thank you, Annie. Two points. The first point is that whether care is possible or probable, if it's not something that is being pursued in a workers' comp claim, it doesn't matter, and that is the key. It has to be part of the workers' comp case. That's one point. Second point is that now that I'm on the plaintiff petitioner side for MSP compliance, given this TPOC reporting of the MSA, I think it's imperative that plaintiff's attorneys keep a copy of the MSA because it's all going to fall on the burden of the petitioner, the plaintiff. If care is being denied because they have this MSA number, the petitioner is going to be impacted. So they should have a copy of that MSA. They should know that it's important to keep it. And if they are called upon at a later date to support why it was reasonable, of course, they're going to reach out to the vendor, but they should have at least this document to know what it is. But ladies, I really thank you for your time today. We can talk about this forever, but we do hope that everybody can join us for next month's podcast, where we're going to be taking a deeper dive into state-specific MSP compliance issues. So thank you again, Annie and Bridget and Emily from MSPN Network.
Thank you, Rosa.
Thank you.
Bye, Annie.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.